appointment as a daughter-in-law. They had had high hopes of a girl whose family featured on the Sacred 28, but as Astoria refused to raise their grandson Scorpius in the belief that Muggles were scum, family gatherings were often fraught with tension.
Author's note. When the series begins, Draco is, in almost every way, the archetypal bully. With the unquestioning belief in his own superior status he has imbibed from his pureblood parents, he initially offers Harry friendship, on the assumption that the offer needs only to be made to be accepted. The wealth of his family stands in contrast to the poverty of the Weasleys. This, too, is a source of pride to Draco, even though the Weasleys' blood credentials are identical to his own. Everybody recognizes Draco because everybody has known somebody like him. Such people's belief in their own superiority can be infuriating, laughable, or intimidating, depending on the circumstances in which one meets them. Draco succeeds in provoking all of these feelings in Harry, Ron, and Hermione at one time or another. My British editor questioned the fact that Draco was so accomplished at occlumency, which Harry, for all his ability in producing a Patronus so young, never mastered. I argued that it was perfectly consistent with Draco's character that he would find it easy to shut down emotion, to compartmentalize and to deny essential parts of himself. Dumbledore tells Harry, at the end of Order of the Phoenix, that it is an essential part of his humanity that he can feel such pain. With Draco, I was attempting to show that the denial of pain and the suppression of inner conflict can only lead to a damaged person, who is much more likely to inflict damage on other people. Draco never realizes that he becomes, for the best part of a year, the true owner of the Elder Wand. It is as well that he does not, partly because the Dark Lord is skilled in legitimacy and would have killed Draco in a heartbeat if he had had an inkling of the truth. But also because, his latent conscience notwithstanding, Draco remains prey to all the temptations that he has been taught to admire, violence and power among them. I pity Draco, just as I feel sorry for Dudley. Being raised by either the Malfoys or the Dursleys would be a very damaging experience. And Draco undergoes dreadful trials as a direct result of his family's misguided principles. However, the Malfoys do have a saving grace. They love each other. Draco is motivated quite as much by fear of something happening to his parents as to himself, while Narcissa risks everything when she lies to Voldemort at the end of Deathly Hallows and tells him that Harry is dead, merely so that she can get to her son. For all this, Draco remains a person of dubious morality in the 7 published books. And I have often had cause to remark on how unnerved I have been by the number of girls who fell for this particular fictional character. Although I do not discount the appeal of Tom Felton, who plays Draco brilliantly in the films and, ironically, is about the nicest person you could meet. Draco has all the dark glamour of the anti-hero. Girls are very apt to romanticize such people. All of this left me in the unenviable position of pouring cold common sense on ardent readers' daydreams as I told them, rather severely, that Draco was not concealing a heart of gold under all that sneering and prejudice, and that no, he and Harry were not destined to end up best friends. I imagine that Draco grew up to lead a modified version of his father's existence. Independently wealthy, without any need to work, Draco inhabits Malfoy Manor with his wife and son. I see in his hobbies further confirmation of his dual nature. The collection of dark artifacts harks back to family history, even though he keeps them in glass cases and does not use them. However, his strange interest in alchemical manuscripts, from which he never attempts to make a philosopher's stone, hints at a wish for something other than wealth, perhaps even the wish to be a better man. I have high hopes that he will raise Scorpius to be a much kinder and more tolerant Malfoy than he was in his own youth. Draco had many surnames before I settled on Malfoy. At various times in the earliest drafts, he is Smart, Sphinx, or Spungen. His Christian name comes from a constellation, the dragon, and yet his wand core is of unicorn. This was symbolic. There is, after all, and at the risk of rekindling unhealthy fantasies, some unextinguished good at the heart of Draco.
Pure blood. The Malfoys might believe themselves to be special, but they are, unfortunately, by no means the only Wizarding World family obsessed with blood status. When the Chamber of Secrets is opened during Harry's second year at Hogwarts, it is revealed that Salazar Slytherin, founder of the Hogwarts House, had been one of the first to espouse the pure blood line of thinking. Thousands of years later, Slytherin's house continues to accept only students that fit his criteria. The Sorting Hat routinely sings about Slytherin's focus on students with the purest ancestry, and many, although not all, members of the Sacred 28 families find their place in Slytherin House. But who exactly are the Sacred 28? The time has come to pull down that pure blood directory and find out more about the ideology that so influences the Malfoys and others.
The term pure blood refers to a family or individual without Muggle, non-magic blood. The concept is generally associated with Salazar Slytherin, one of the four founders of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, whose aversion to teaching anybody of Muggle parentage eventually led to a breach with his three fellow founders and his resignation from the school. Slytherin's discrimination on the basis of parentage was considered an unusual and misguided view by the majority of wizards at the time. Contemporary literature suggests that Muggleborns were not only accepted, but often considered to be particularly gifted. They went by the affectionate name of Madgebobs. There's been much debate about the origin of the term, but it seems most likely to be that in such a case, magic bobbed up out of nowhere. Magical opinion underwent something of a shift after the International Statute of Secrecy became effective in 1692, when the magical community went into voluntary hiding following persecution by Muggles. This was a traumatic time for witches and wizards, and marriages with Muggles dropped to their lowest level ever known, mainly because of fears that intermarriage would lead inevitably to discovery and consequently to a serious infraction of wizarding law.
Footnote. Over subsequent decades and centuries, the number of mixed marriages began to climb again to the healthy levels of today. And this has not led to widespread discovery of the hidden magical community. Professor Mordecai Egg, author of The Philosophy of the Mundane, Why the Muggles Prefer Not to Know, points out that Muggles in love generally do not betray their husbands or wives. And Muggles who fall out of love are jeered at by their own community when they assert that their estranged partner is a witch or wizard.
Under such conditions of uncertainty, fear, and resentment, the pure blood doctrine began to gain followers. As a general rule, those who adopted it were also those who had most strenuously opposed the International Statute of Secrecy, advocating instead for outright war on the Muggles. Increasing numbers of wizards now preached that marriage with the Muggle did not merely risk a possible breach of the new statute, but that it was shameful, unnatural, and would lead to contamination of magical blood.
Footnote. In fact, the reverse appears to be true. Where families adhered consistently to the practice of marrying within a very small group of fellow witches and wizards, mental and physical instability and weakness seemed to result.
As Muggle-wizard marriage had been common for centuries, those now self-describing as purebloods were unlikely to have any higher proportion of wizarding ancestors than those who did not. To call oneself a pureblood was more accurately a declaration of political or social intent. I will not marry a Muggle and I consider Muggle-wizard marriage reprehensible, than a statement of biological fact. Several works of dubious scholarship published around the early 18th century, and drawing partly on the writings of Salazar Slytherin himself, make reference to supposed indicators of pure blood status, aside from the family tree. The most commonly cited signs were onset of magical ability before the age of 3, early before age 7, prowess on a broomstick, dislike or fear of pigs and those who tend them. The pig is often considered a particularly non-magical animal and is notoriously difficult to charm. Resistance to common childhood illnesses, outstanding physical attractiveness, and an aversion to muggles observable even in the pure blood baby, which supposedly shows signs of fear and disgust in their presence. Successive studies produced by the Department of Mysteries have proven that these supposed hallmarks of pure blood status have no basis in fact. Nevertheless, many purebloods continue to cite them as evidence of their own higher status within the wizarding community. In the early 1930s, a pure blood directory was published anonymously in Britain, which listed the 28 truly pure blood families, as judged by the unknown authority who had written the book.
Footnote: widely believed to be cantankerous not.
With the aim of helping such families maintain the purity of their bloodlines. The so-called Sacred 28 comprised the families of Abbott, Avery, Black, Bulstrode, Burke, Carrow, Crouch, Fawley, Flint, Gaunt, Greengrass, Lestrange, Longbottom, Macmillan, Malfoy, Knott, Ollivander, Parkinson, Pruitt, Rosier, Rowell, Selwyn, Shacklebolt, Shafiq, Slughorn, Travers, Weasley, Yaxley. A minority of these families publicly deplored their inclusion on the list, declaring that their ancestors certainly included muggles, a fact of which they were not ashamed. Most vocally indignant was the numerous Weasley family, which, in spite of its connections with almost every old wizarding family in Britain, was proud of its ancestral ties to many interesting muggles. Their protests earned these families the opprobrium of advocates of the pure blood doctrine and the epithet blood traitor. Meanwhile, a larger number of families were protesting that they were not on the pure blood list.
Let's put that pure blood directory back on the shelf and move on to a far less dubious topic. Now, the following fascinating subject has been the focus of much more rigorous academic attention, even if it is mostly academic attention from one highly skilled wand maker. Chapter 3. Wands. As the UK's preeminent wand maker, Mr. Garrick Ollivander's skill, expertise, and fascination with wand lore means he almost single-handedly supplies the wands for our favourite Harry Potter characters. Although, to hear Ollivander tell it, he isn't a wand salesman, more like a wand's middleman. After all, as he says to Harry, it's really the wand that chooses the wizard. Ollivander is memorably introduced in Philosopher's Stone. Harry's experience in his shabby but magical wand-making shop foreshadows a lot of what is to come. It is obviously where Harry acquires the wand that goes on to save his life on numerous occasions. Holly and Phoenix Feather, 11 inches, nice and supple. And it is also where he learns that his wand shares a core with Voldemort's. Both contain a feather from the same phoenix. A few years later, Harry learns that the phoenix in question is Dumbledore's own fox, and the wand's twin cores become highly significant. The connection between Harry's wand and Voldemort's might be particularly rare, but every wand sold in Ollivander's shop is unique. So just what is it that makes an Ollivander wand so very special? It seems only Mr. Ollivander himself, with his one-of-a-kind perspective about the mysteries of wand making, can even begin to explain. Mr. Ollivander. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's meet Mr. Ollivander. We'll start right where Harry does, in Ollivander's gloomy shop, full of narrow boxes and secret magic, empty but for a single spindly chair. These premises in Diagon Alley bear the legend Ollivander's, makers of fine wands since 382 BC, in peeling gold letters. So it's fair to say, his is a long-established family business. And every family has a story.
The family of Ollivander has long been associated with the mysterious profession of wandcraft. It is said that the name means he who owns the olive wand, which suggests that the original Ollivander arrived in Britain from a Mediterranean country, olive trees not being native to the UK. Mr. Ollivander himself believes that his earliest forebears in this country arrived with the Romans and set up stall, subsequently shop, to sell to ancient British wizards whose wands were of crude construction and unreliable in performance. Mr. Ollivander is arguably the finest maker of wands in the world, and many foreigners travel to London to purchase one of his wands in preference to those on offer in their native lands. Mr. Ollivander grew up in the family business, in which he showed precocious talent. He had the ambition of improving upon the cores and wand woods hitherto used, and from his earliest days conceived a single-minded, even fanatical determination in his pursuit of the ideal wand. Prior to Mr. Ollivander's proprietorship of the family business, wizards used a wide variety of wand cores. A customer would often present the wand maker with a magical substance to which they were attached or had inherited, or by which their family swore, hinted at by the core of Fleur Delacour's wand. Mr. Ollivander, however, was a purist, who insisted that the best wands would never be produced merely by encasing the whiskers of a favourite measle or the stalk of a dittany plant that once saved a wizard's father from poisoning, or the mane of a kelpie a witch had once met on holiday in Scotland, in the customer's favourite wood. The best wands, he believed, had cores of immensely powerful magical substances, which were expertly enclosed in specially selected and complementary wandwoods, the result to be matched to an owner with whom the wand itself felt the most affinity. While there was initially substantial resistance to this revolutionary way of crafting wands, it swiftly became clear that Ollivander wands were infinitely superior to anything that had come before. His methods of locating wandwoods and core substances, marrying them together and matching them to ideal owners, are all jealously guarded secrets that were coveted by rival wand makers.
Wand cores. At the core of every wand is a magical substance. And if you are in possession of an Ollivander wand, that core will be one of only three things. The first of these is unicorn hair. Ron Weasley was in possession of no less than two unicorn hair wands during his time at Hogwarts. The one he arrived with, and the one he acquired after his original wand was destroyed by the Whomping Willow. Unicorn hair is also found in the wands of Cedric Diggory, Draco Malfoy, and Neville Longbottom. Next up is Dragon Heartstring, which is at the core of wands belonging to Victor Crumb, Lucius Malfoy, Bellatrix Lestrange, Peter Pettigrew, and Hermione Granger. Mr. Ollivander will expand on this very Death Eater heavy list. The third magical Ollivander substance, Phoenix Feather, is, as we've already seen, at the core of both Harry Potter and Voldemort's wands. Other magical substances are available to use in wand creation. Those who recall Mr. Ollivander's appearance at the Triwizard Tournament's Wane of the Wands ceremony will remember that Beauxbatons student Fleur Delacour's wand contains a hair from the head of Avila. Though such a substance will never be found in an Ollivander wand, as the man himself explains.
The following description of the powers and properties of the three main wand cores used by Mr. Garrick Ollivander is taken from his own notes.
Early in my career, as I watched my wandmaker father wrestling with substandard wand core materials such as kelpie hair, I conceived the ambition to discover the finest cores and to work only with those when my time came to take over the family business. This I have done. After much experimentation and research, I concluded that only three substances produce wands of the quality to which I am happy to give the illustrious name of Ollivander. Unicorn hair, dragon heartstring, and phoenix feather. Each of these costly and rare materials has its own distinct properties. The following represents a short summary of my research into each of the three supreme cores. Readers should bear in mind that each one is the composite of its wood, its core, and the experience and nature of its owner. The tendencies of each may counterbalance or outweigh the other. So this can only be a very general overview of an immensely complex subject. Unicorn. Unicorn hair generally produces the most consistent magic and is least subject to fluctuations and blockages. Wands with unicorn cores are generally the most difficult to turn to the dark arts. They are the most faithful of all wands and usually remain strongly attached to their first owner, irrespective of whether he or she was an accomplished witch or wizard. Minor disadvantages of unicorn hair are that they do not make the most powerful wands, although the wand wood may compensate, and that they are prone to melancholy if seriously mishandled, meaning that the hair may die and need replacing. Dragon. As a rule, dragon heartstrings produce wands with the most power and which are capable of the most flamboyant spells. Dragon wands tend to learn more quickly than other types. While they can change allegiance if won from their original master, they always bond strongly with the current owner. The dragon wand tends to be easiest to turn to the dark arts, though it will not incline that way of its own accord. It is also the most prone of the three cores to accidents, being somewhat temperamental. Phoenix. This is the rarest core type. Phoenix feathers are capable of the greatest range of magic, though they may take longer than either unicorn or dragon cores to reveal this. They show the most initiative, sometimes acting of their own accord, a quality that many witches and wizards dislike. Phoenix feather ones are always the pickiest when it comes to potential owners, for the creature from which they are taken is one of the most independent and detached in the world. These ones are the hardest to tame and to personalize, and their allegiance is usually hard won.
Wand woods. Ollivander may only use three magical substances to create his wand cores, but when it comes to wand woods, there are a lot of options. A forest full, if you will. From acacia to yew, the alphabetical list that follows expands on the pros and cons of every type of wandwood, including elm, as found in Lucius Malfoy's, hawthorn, which the wand of Lucius's son, Draco, is made of, and oak, the wood used to create Hagrid's wand. You know, the one he hides in a pink umbrella after being expelled from Hogwarts. It's interesting to read Ollivander's descriptions of wandwoods and think about how they relate to some of our favourite characters. Voldemort's wand is made of yew, for example, which Ollivander says will never choose either a mediocre or a timid owner. Holly, which Harry's own wand is made of, works most happily for those who may need help overcoming a tendency to anger and impetuosity. And Ollivander's willow wands consistently selected those of greatest potential, rather than those who feel they have little to learn. Both Harry's mother Lily and his best friend Ron have wands made of willow. Other notable wand woods to look out for include Cherry, Neville Longbottom's new wand, one of the last to be made by Ollivander before the Wandmaker is kidnapped by Voldemort, Vine, Hermione Granger's, and Walnut, Bellatrix Lestrange's, the one Hermione unwillingly uses when impersonating her in Deathly Hallows. With all that in mind, Mr. Ollivander is readying himself for another wand wood walk.
The following description of the powers and properties of various wandwoods is taken from notes made over a long career by Mr. Garrick Ollivander, widely considered the best wandmaker in the world. as will be seen, Mr. Ollivander believes that Wandwood has almost human powers of perception and preferences. Mr. Ollivander introduces his notes on Wandwoods thus.
Every single wand is unique and will depend for its character on the particular tree and magical creature from which it derives its materials. Moreover, each wand, from the moment it finds its ideal owner, will begin to learn from and teach its human partner. Therefore, the following must be seen as general notes on each of the wood types I like to work with best, and ought not to be taken to describe any individual wand. Only a minority of trees can produce wand-quality wood, just as a minority of humans can produce magic. It takes years of experience to tell which ones have the gift, although the job is made easier if bow truckles are found nesting in the leaves, as they never inhabit mundane trees. The following notes on various wand woods should be regarded very much as a starting point, for this is the study of a lifetime, and I continue to learn with every wand I make and match. Acacia, a very unusual wand wood, which I have found creates tricky wands that often refuse to produce magic for any but their owner, and also withhold their best effects from all but those most gifted. This sensitivity renders them difficult to place, and I keep only a small stock for those witches or wizards of sufficient subtlety, for acacia is not suited to what is commonly known as bangs and smells magic. When well matched, an acacia wand matches any for power, though it is often underrated due to the peculiarity of its temperament. Alder. Alder is an unyielding wood, yet I have discovered that its ideal owner is not stubborn or obstinate, but often helpful, considerate, and most likable. Whereas most wand woods seek similarity in the characters of those they will best serve, alder is unusual in that it seems to desire a nature that is, if not precisely opposite to its own, then certainly of a markedly different type. When an older wand is happily placed, it becomes a magnificent, loyal helpmate. Of all wand types, alder is best suited to nonverbal spell work, whence comes its reputation for being suitable only for the most advanced witches and wizards. Apple. Applewood wands are not made in great numbers. They are powerful and best suited to an owner of high aims and ideals, as this wood mixes poorly with dark magic. It is said that the possessor of an apple wand will be well-loved and long-lived, and I have often noticed that customers of great personal charm find their perfect match in an applewood wand. An unusual ability to converse with other magical beings in their native tongues is often found among apple wand owners, who include the celebrated author of Mare People, A Comprehensive Guide to Their Language and Customs, Dylan Marwood. Ash. The ash wand cleaves to its one true master and ought not to be passed on or gifted from the original owner, because it would lose power and skill. This tendency is extreme if the core is of unicorn. Old superstitions regarding wands rarely bear close examination, but I find that the old rhyme regarding rowan, chestnut, ash, and hazel wands, rowan gossips, chestnut drones, ashes stubborn, hazel moans, contains a small nugget of truth. Those witches and wizards best suited to ash wands are not, in my experience, lightly swayed from their beliefs or purposes. However, the brash or overconfident witch or wizard, who often insists on trying wands of this prestigious wood, will be disappointed by its effects. The ideal owner may be stubborn and will certainly be courageous, but never crass or arrogant. Aspen. Wand quality aspen wood is white and fine-grained and highly prized by all wand makers for its stylish resemblance to ivory and its usually outstanding charm work. The proper owner of the aspen wand is often an accomplished duelist, or destined to be so, for the Aspen Wand is one of those particularly suited to martial magic. An infamous and secretive 18th century dueling club, which called itself the Silver Spears, was reputed to admit only those who owned Aspen Wands. In my experience, Aspen Wand owners are generally strong-minded and determined, more likely than most to be attracted by quests and new orders. This is a wand for revolutionaries. Beech. The true match for a beech wand will be, if young, wise beyond his or her years, and if full-grown, rich in understanding and experience. Beech wands perform very weakly for the narrow-minded and intolerant. Such wizards and witches, having obtained a beech wand without having been suitably matched, yet coveting this most desirable, richly hued and highly prized wandwood, have often presented themselves at the homes of learned wandmakers such as myself, demanding to know the reason for their handsome wand's lack of power. When properly matched, the beech wand is capable of a subtlety and artistry rarely seen in any other wood, hence its lustrous reputation. Blackthorn. Blackthorn, which is a very unusual wandwood, has the reputation, in my view, well merited, of being best suited to a warrior. This does not necessarily mean that its owner practices the dark arts, although it is undeniable that those who do so will enjoy the Blackthorn Wand's prodigious power. One finds Blackthorn Wands among the Aurors, as well as among the denizens of Azkaban. It is a curious feature of the Blackthorn Bush, which sports wicked thorns, that it produces its sweetest berries after the hardest frosts, and the wands made from this wood appear to need to pass through danger or hardship with their owners to become truly bonded. Given this condition, the Blackthorn Wand will become as loyal and faithful a servant as one could wish. Black Walnut. Less common than the standard walnut wand, that of Black Walnut seeks a master of good instincts and powerful insight. Black Walnut is a very handsome wood, but not the easiest to master. It has one pronounced quirk, which is that it is abnormally attuned to inner conflict and loses power dramatically if its possessor practices any form of self-deception. If the witch or wizard is unable or unwilling to be honest with themselves or others, the wand often fails to perform adequately and must be matched with a new owner if it is to regain its former prowess. Paired with a sincere, self-aware owner, however, it becomes one of the most loyal and impressive wands of all, with a particular flair in all kinds of charm work. Cedar. Whenever I meet one who carries a cedar wand, I find strength of character and unusual loyalty. My father, Gervase Ollivander, used always to say, "You will never fool the cedar carrier." And I agree. The cedar wand finds its perfect home where there is perspicacity and perception. I would go further than my father, however, in saying that I have never yet met the owner of a cedar wand whom I would care to cross, especially if harm is done to those of whom they are fond. The witch or wizard who is well matched with cedar carries the potential to be a frightening adversary, which often comes as a shock to those who have thoughtlessly challenged them. Cherry. This very rare wand wood creates a wand of strange power, most highly prized by the wizarding students of the school of Mahotokoro in Japan, where those who own cherry wands have special prestige. The Western wand purchaser should dispel from their mind any notion that the pink blossom of the living tree makes for a frivolous or merely ornamental wand. For cherry wood often makes a wand that possesses truly lethal power, whatever the core. But if teamed with dragon heartstring, the wand ought never to be teamed with a wizard without exceptional self-control and strength of mind. Chestnut. This is a most curious, multifaceted wood, which varies greatly in its character depending on the wand core, and takes a great deal of color from the personality that possesses it. The wand of chestnut is attracted to witches and wizards who are skilled tamers of magical beasts, those who possess great gifts in herbology, and those who are natural flyers. However, when paired with dragon heartstring, it may find its best match among those who are over-fond of luxury and material things, and less scrupulous than they should be about how they are obtained. Conversely, three successive heads of the wizened gamut have possessed chestnut and unicorn wands, for this combination shows a predilection for those concerned with all manner of justice. Cypress wands are associated with nobility. The great medieval wand maker, Geraint Ollivander, wrote that he was always honored to match a cypress wand, for he knew he was meeting a witch or wizard who would die a heroic death. Fortunately, in these less bloodthirsty times, the possessors of cypress wands are rarely called upon to lay down their lives, though doubtless many of them would do so if required. Wands of cypress find their soulmates among the brave, the bold, and the self-sacrificing, those who are unafraid to confront the shadows in their own and others' natures. Dogwood. Dogwood is one of my own personal favorites, and I have found that matching a dogwood wand with its ideal owner is always entertaining. Dogwood wands are quirky and mischievous. They have playful natures and insist upon partners who can provide them with scope for excitement and fun. It would be quite wrong, however, to deduce from this that dogwood wands are not capable of serious magic when called upon to do so. They have been known to perform outstanding spells under difficult conditions, and when paired with a suitably clever and ingenious witch or wizard, can produce dazzling enchantments. An interesting foible of many dogwood wands is that they refuse to perform non-verbal spells, and they are often rather noisy. Ebony. This jet-black wand wood has an impressive appearance and reputation, being highly suited to all manner of combative magic and to transfiguration. Ebony is happiest in the hand of those with the courage to be themselves. Frequently nonconformist, highly individual, or comfortable with the status of outsider, ebony wand owners have been found both among the ranks of the Order of the Phoenix and among the Death Eaters. In my experience, the ebony wand's perfect match is one who will hold fast to his or her beliefs no matter what the external pressure, and will not be swayed lightly from their purpose. Elder. The rarest wandwood of all, and reputed to be deeply unlucky, the elder wand is trickier to master than any other. It contains powerful magic, but scorns to remain with any owner who is not the superior of his or her company. It takes a remarkable wizard to keep the elder wand for any length of time. The old superstition, wand of elder never prosper, has its basis in this fear of the wand, but in fact, the superstition is baseless, and those foolish wand makers who refuse to work with elder do so more because they doubt they will be able to sell their products than from fear of working with this wood. The truth is that only a highly unusual person will find their perfect match in elder. And on the rare occasion when such a pairing occurs, I take it as certain that the witch or wizard in question is marked out for a special destiny. An additional fact that I have unearthed during my long years of study is that the owners of elder wands almost always feel a powerful affinity with those chosen by Rowan. elm. The unfounded belief that only pure bloods can produce magic from elm wands was undoubtedly started by some elm wand owner seeking to prove his own blood credentials. For I have known perfect matches of elm wands who are muggle-borns. The truth is that elm wands prefer owners with presence, magical dexterity, and a certain native dignity. Of all wand woods, elm, in my experience, produces the fewest accidents, the least foolish errors, and the most elegant charms and spells. These are sophisticated wands, capable of highly advanced magic in the right hands, which, again, makes it highly desirable to those who espouse the pure blood philosophy. English oak. A wand for good times and bad, this is a friend as loyal as the wizard who deserves it. Wands of English oak demand partners of strength, courage, and fidelity. Less well known is the propensity for owners of English oak wands to have powerful intuition and often an affinity with the magic of the natural world, with the creatures and plants that are necessary to wizardkind for both magic and pleasure. The oak tree is called King of the Forest from the winter solstice up until the summer solstice, and its wood should only be collected during that time. Holly becomes king as the days begin to shorten again, and so holly should only be gathered as the year wanes. This divide is believed to be the origin of the old superstition. When his wand's oak and hers is holly, then to marry would be folly. A superstition that I have found baseless. It is said that Merlin's wand was of English oak, though his grave has never been found, so this cannot be proven. Fir. My august grandfather, Gerbald Octavius Ollivander, always called wands of this wood the survivor's wand, because he had sold it to three wizards who subsequently passed through mortal peril unscathed. There is no doubt that this wood, coming as it does from the most resilient of trees, produces wands that demand staying power and strength of purpose in their true owners, and that they are poor tools in the hands of the changeable and indecisive. Fir wands are particularly suited to transfiguration and favor owners of focused, strong-minded, and occasionally intimidating demeanor. Hawthorn. The wand maker, Grigorovich, wrote that hawthorn makes a strange contradictory wand, as full of paradoxes as the tree that gave it birth, whose leaves and blossoms heal, and yet whose cut branches smell of death. While I disagree with many of Grigorovich's conclusions, we concur about hawthorn wands, which are complex and intriguing in their natures, just like the owners who best suit them. Hawthorn wands may be particularly suited to healing magic, but they are also adept at curses, and I have generally observed that the hawthorn wand seems most at home with a conflicted nature, or with a witch or wizard passing through a period of turmoil. Hawthorn is not easy to master, however, and I would only ever consider placing a hawthorn wand in the hands of a witch or wizard of proven talent, or the consequences might be dangerous. Hawthorn wands have a notable peculiarity. Their spells can, when badly handled, backfire. Hazel, a sensitive wand. Hazel often reflects its owner's emotional state and works best for a master who understands and can manage their own feelings. Others should be very careful handling a hazel wand if its owner has recently lost their temper or suffered a serious disappointment, because the wand will absorb such energy and discharge it unpredictably. The positive aspect of a hazel wand more than makes up for such minor discomforts, however, for it is capable of outstanding magic in the hands of the skillful, and is so devoted to its owner that it often wilts, which is to say it expels all its magic and refuses to perform, often necessitating the extraction of the core and its insertion into another casing if the wand is still required, at the end of its master's life. If the core is unicorn hair, however, there is no hope. The wand will almost certainly have died. Hazel wands also have the unique ability to detect water underground and will emit silvery, tear-shaped puffs of smoke if passing over concealed springs and wells. Holly. Holly is one of the rarer kinds of wand woods. Traditionally considered protective, it works most happily for those who may need help overcoming a tendency to anger and impetuosity. At the same time, holly wands often choose owners who are engaged in some dangerous and often spiritual quest. Holly is one of those woods that varies most dramatically in performance depending on the wand core. And it is a notoriously difficult wood to team with Phoenix Feather, as the wood's volatility conflicts strangely with the phoenix's detachment. In the unusual event of such a pairing finding its ideal match, however, nothing and nobody should stand in their way. Hornbeam. My own wand is made of hornbeam, and so it is with all due modesty that I state that hornbeam selects for its life mate the talented witch or wizard with a single pure passion, which some might call obsession, though I prefer the term vision, which will almost always be realized. Hornbeam wands adapt more quickly than almost any other to their owner's style of magic, and will become so personalized so quickly that other people will find them extremely difficult to use even for the most simple of spells. Hornbeam wands likewise absorb their owner's code of honor, whatever that might be, and will refuse to perform acts, whether for good or ill, that do not tally with their master's principles. A particularly fine-tuned and sentient wand. Larch. Strong, durable, and warm in color, larch has long been valued as an attractive and powerful wand wood. Its reputation for instilling courage and confidence in the user has ensured that demand has always outstripped supply. This much sought-after wand is, however, hard to please in the matter of ideal owners, and trickier to handle than many imagine. I find that it always creates wands of hidden talents and unexpected effects, which likewise describes the master who deserves it. It is often the case that the witch or wizard who belongs to the larch wand may never realize the full extent of their considerable talents until paired with it, but that they will then make an exceptional match. Laurel. It is said that a laurel wand cannot perform a dishonorable act, although in the quest for glory, a not uncommon goal for those best suited to these wands, I have known laurel wands perform powerful and sometimes lethal magic. Laurel wands are sometimes called fickle, but this is unfair. The laurel wand seems unable to tolerate laziness in a possessor, and it is in such conditions that it is most easily and willingly won away. Otherwise, it will cleave happily to its first match forever, and indeed has the unusual and engaging attribute of issuing a spontaneous lightning strike if another witch or wizard attempts to steal it. Maple. I have often found that those chosen by maple wands are by nature travelers and explorers. They are not stay-at-home wands and prefer ambition in their witch or wizard. Otherwise, their magic grows heavy and lackluster. Fresh challenges and regular changes of scene cause this wand to literally shine, burnishing itself as it grows with its partner in ability and status. This is a beautiful and desirable wood, and one quality maple has been among the most costly for centuries. Possession of a maple wand has long been a mark of status because of its reputation as the wand of high achievers. Pear. This golden-toned wood produces wands of splendid magical powers, which give of their best in the hands of the warm-hearted, the generous, and the wise. Possessors of pair wands are, in my experience, usually popular and well-respected. I do not know of a single instance where a pair wand has been discovered in the possession of a dark witch or wizard. Pair wands are among the most resilient, and I have often observed that they may still present a remarkable appearance of newness, even after many years of hard use. Pine. The straight-grained pine wand always chooses an independent, individual master, who may be perceived as a loner, intriguing, and perhaps mysterious. Pine wands enjoy being used creatively, and unlike some others, will adapt unprotestingly to new methods and spells. Many wand makers insist that pine wands are able to detect and perform best for owners who are destined for long lives, and I can confirm this inasmuch as I have never personally known the master of a pine wand to die young. The pine wand is one of those that is most sensitive to non-verbal magic. Poplar. If you seek integrity, search first among the poplars, was a great maxim of my grandfather, Jerbold Ollivander, and my own experience of poplar wands and their owners tallies exactly with his. Here is a wand to rely upon, of consistency, strength, and uniform power, always happiest when working with a witch or wizard of clear moral vision. There is a tired old joke among lesser wand makers that no poplar wand has ever chosen a politician. But here they show their lamentable ignorance. Two of the ministry's most accomplished ministers for magic, Eldridge Diggory and Evangeline Orpington, were the possessors of fine Ollivander-made poplar wands. Red oak. You will often hear the ignorant say that red oak is an infallible sign of its owner's hot temper. In fact, the true match for a red oak wand is possessed of unusually fast reactions, making it a perfect dueling wand. Less common than English oak, I have found that its ideal master is light of touch, quick-witted, and adaptable, often the creator of distinctive trademark spells, and a good man or woman to have beside one in a fight. Red oak wands are, in my opinion, among the most handsome. Redwood. Wand-quality redwood is in short supply, yet constant demand, due to its reputation for bringing good fortune to its owner. As is usually the case with wand lore, the general populace has the truth back to front. Redwood wands are not themselves lucky, but are strongly attracted to witches and wizards who already possess the admirable ability to fall on their feet to make the right choice, to snatch advantage from catastrophe. The combination of such a witch or wizard with a redwood wand is always intriguing, and I generally expect to hear of exciting exploits when I send this special pairing out from my workshop. Rowan. Rowan wood has always been much favored for wands because it is reputed to be more protective than any other, and in my experience, renders all manner of defensive charms especially strong and difficult to break. It is commonly stated that no dark witch or wizard ever owned a Rowan wand, and I cannot recall a single instance where one of my own Rowan wands has gone on to do evil in the world. Rowan is most happily placed with the clear-headed and the pure-hearted. But this reputation for virtue ought not to fool anyone. These wands are the equal of any, often the better, and frequently outperform others in duels. Silver lime. This unusual and highly attractive wand wood was greatly in vogue in the 19th century. Demand outstripped supply, and unscrupulous wand makers dyed substandard woods in an effort to fool purchasers into believing that they had purchased silver lime. The reasons for these wands' desirability lay not only in their unusually handsome appearance, but also because they had a reputation for performing best for seers and those skilled in legilimency, mysterious arts both, which consequently gave the possessor of a silver lime wand considerable status. When demand was at its height, wandmaker Arturo Cephalopus claimed that the association between silver lime and clairvoyance was a falsehood circulated by merchants like Gerbold Ollivander, my own grandfather, who have overstocked their workshops with silver lime and hope to shift their surplus. But Cephalopus was a slipshod wandmaker and an ignoramus, and nobody, seer or not, was surprised when he went out of business. Spruce. Unskilled wandmakers call spruce a difficult wood, but in doing so, they reveal their own ineptitude. It is quite true that it requires particular deftness to work with spruce, which produces ones that are ill-matched with cautious or nervous natures and become positively dangerous in fumbling fingers. The spruce wand requires a firm hand, because it often appears to have its own ideas about what magic it ought to be called upon to produce. However, when a spruce wand meets its match, which, in my experience, is a bold spellcaster with a good sense of humor, it becomes a superb helper, intensely loyal to their owners and capable of producing particularly flamboyant and dramatic effects. Sycamore. The sycamore makes a questing wand, eager for new experiences and losing brilliance if engaged in mundane activities. It is a quirk of these handsome ones that they may combust if allowed to become bored, and many witches and wizards, settling down into middle age, are disconcerted to find their trusty wand bursting into flame in their hand as they ask it one more time to fetch their slippers. As may be deduced, the sycamore's ideal owner is curious, vital, and adventurous, and when paired with such an owner, it demonstrates a capacity to learn and adapt that earns it a rightful place among the world's most highly prized wand woods. Vine. The Druids considered anything with a woody stem as a tree, and vine makes wands of such a special nature that I have been happy to continue their ancient tradition. Vine wands are among the less common types, and I have been intrigued to notice that their owners are nearly always those witches or wizards who seek a greater purpose, who have a vision beyond the ordinary, and who frequently astound those who think they know them best. Vine wands seem strongly attracted by personalities with hidden depths, and I have found them more sensitive than any other when it comes to instantly detecting a prospective match. Reliable sources claim that these wands can emit magical effects upon the mere entrance into their room of a suitable owner, and I have twice observed the phenomenon in my own shop. Walnut. Highly intelligent witches and wizards ought to be offered a walnut wand for trial first, because in 9 cases out of 10, the two will find in each other their ideal mate. Walnut wands are often found in the hands of magical innovators and inventors. This is a handsome wood, possessed of unusual versatility and adaptability. A note of caution, however, while some woods are difficult to dominate and may resist the performance of spells that are foreign to their natures, the walnut wand will, once subjugated, perform any task its owner desires, provided that the user is of sufficient brilliance. This makes for a truly lethal weapon in the hands of a witch or wizard of no conscience. For the wand and the wizard may feed from each other in a particularly unhealthy manner. Willow. Willow is an uncommon wandwood with healing power, and I have noted that the ideal owner for a willow wand often has some, usually unwarranted, insecurity, however well they may try and hide it. While many confident customers insist on trying a willow wand, attracted by their handsome appearance and well-founded reputation for enabling advanced, non-verbal magic, my willow ones have consistently selected those of greatest potential, rather than those who feel they have little to learn. It has always been a proverb in my family that he who has furthest to travel will go fastest with willow. You ones are among the rarer kinds, and their ideal matches are likewise unusual and occasionally notorious.